Live from Beyond the Beltway, this is Bruce Dumont with our weekly analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by pro-Israeli attorney and longtime guest on this program, Josh Cantrow. Yosef Skoukami, an attorney, a pro-Palestinian American, he joins us, as well as John Allen Williams, Loyola University Emeritus, and later in the program, we'll be joined by Paul Lisnick, who is the political analyst for WGN Television, but of course, his claim to fame is many years ago, he was a key analyst of the O.J. Simpson trial, and we will be talking with him about his the memories he has of that trial. But most importantly as well, he is an expert, in fact, has even written a book on jury selection. So in the wake of Donald Trump's jury selection trial, which starts tomorrow in New York, he'll be giving us some tips on jury selection and what the defense for Donald Trump might be looking for and hoping for. So that's the program this evening. Lots going on, obviously. We have the ongoing battle in the Middle East with Iran showering Israel with close to 300 missiles and drones trying to get through them, but very few got through. Thanks to the defense of the United States, Israel, and others. And I want to start with that subject with John Allen Williams, who has written a book on U.S. National security and is an expert in this field. He joins us from his home in Macon, Georgia. John, give us an update insofar as how was Israel and the West, how were they able to withstand this onslaught from Iran?
Well, I think the Iranians must have been very surprised that their attack failed as it did. The only damage that was done inside Israel was some minor damage to an airbase, and a 7-year-old Muslim Bedouin girl was seriously injured by falling a shrapnel. Mm-hmm. Between the United States, which had prepared for this, and they had two guided missile destroyers with Aegis anti-air systems on board that could shoot down aircraft, drones, et cetera. We have other aircraft carriers with aircraft on them and able to fight. And also we have just ground-based aircraft there. Plus the British say they shot down a few drones. Mm-hmm. And I understand that Lebanese and the French also got involved in this. So Israel had a lot of help. But mm-hmm. the main thing is that Israel has a very effective layered air defense system. I used to do this in the Navy.
Was this something above and beyond what Israel had independently? Did they need the help of the United States and France and Great Britain?
Well, in an attack on this of this size, mm-hmm. you need all the help you can get.
Right.
And part of it was, the Israeli system has the Iron Dome for close in defense, but it's mm-hmm. also got something called Devil's Sling, which is a little further out, and then Arrow 2, which was based on the U.S. Patriot. And then Arrow 3, which actually can reach all the way up into space and get ballistic missiles there.
Mm-hmm.
So their defense system is really, really very good.
Now, in this particular case, obviously, the onslaught was impressive in its numbers. It was not yes. impressive in its lack of success. The world is right. already sort of responding now and basically saying that Iran was not able to do any great damage in this particular case. Now, how does Iran respond to this international assessment of their lack of success? And how does Israel respond to this obvious attempt to do great damage in their country, even though they didn't accomplish that? What happens next in the military minds of each side here, John, in your view?
Well, the Iranians cannot be happy with the results of this.
I wouldn't think so.
Because the threat that they hold over Israel is, well, we've got all these rockets, and, if you annoy us sufficiently, we're going to launch them at you. Well, they did, rockets, drones, and cruise missiles, and they didn't get through. That makes one wonder, and I think the Iranians possibly suspect that if the Israelis were to attack them, the Israeli missiles might have a little better luck than theirs did.
Mm-hmm.
But the question is, for Iran says it's okay. We made our point. We're done. Just don't. But if you come back at us, then we will massively. Well, maybe it, maybe not.
And they basically have said that, you know, we blew our load here, and you got our attention. The world is now aware of what we did, but you know, we're not looking for a bigger fight here. Is that correct?
Well, that's what they are saying, and I think that's probably true. They don't want a wider war, but they want Israel destroyed, and they want it replaced by Greater Palestine, and they want the United States out of the Middle East. And they want to increase their own power in the Middle East, which is why some of the other Arab states supported Israel in this.
One last question, and then I know our guests in studio want to ask you questions as well. But one last question: does this lack of military success at this moment, does this suggest that maybe Iran is a paper tiger, and that the United States and much of the West, they've been worrying about big bad Iran for a long time, when in reality, maybe Iran isn't, maybe they're still bad, but maybe they're not that big, and they're really not very effective as a fighting force?
Well, you know, we used to say Russians aren't 10 feet tall, but there's a lot of them about 5'10", you know. Iran is a very big, very powerful, very heavily industrialized country that has hardened its facilities and would be a very formidable opponent in a war, especially a war close to them.
Mm-hmm.
And people like John Bolton, the former security advisor to President Trump, who laid out a case that this is perhaps the time for Israel to take out the nuclear program and to take out some bases and that sort of thing,
mm-hmm.
which is, I think, utterly irresponsible. The question is, even the United States may not have the capability to take out those Iranian targets mm-hmm. in a single strike. And Israel really does not.
And I want to. We have guests in studio. I want to give them an opportunity to ask a question, but we're running time. Josh Cantrell, let me introduce you. Ask your question. We're going to have to wait until after the break to hear the answer. But what is your question for Jay?
Yeah, Jay, my question is, this defense that Israel and the United States and Britain and other countries did, how much did they coordinate in terms of who's going to shoot what? Who's going to be responsible for this area or that area? Because it seems to me that's an awful lot of countries involved in this. So I was interested from a military standpoint.
I want to hear your answer to that when we come back. Jay Williams joins us from his home in Macon, Georgia. We've got guests in studio. We will hear more from them when we continue on this edition of Beyond the Beltway, coast to coast and border to border and around the world at beyondthebeltway.com.
Kids want to share what's going on in their lives with the adults around them. Parents, grandparents, teachers, coaches, and more. They want to know you're listening, and they want to listen to you. They want your input and guidance, early and often, on all kinds of topics. When it comes to a serious subject like underage drinking, they want to know your expectations, as well as how and why, as a young person, they should avoid alcohol. How you talk about it will change as your child grows. But the important thing is to talk about it. Not just once for an hour when you think the time is right, but in 60 one-minute conversations and more that are part of your everyday talks. For more information about talking with your kids about underage use of alcohol and other drugs, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov. When you need me, I'll be by your side.
This is the story of a very special woman. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician or an entrepreneur. Her knowledge was limitless and still is. She could also make monsters disappear, especially those that lurked in the shadows under the bed. Once, this woman put back together a teenage girl's broken heart, which had been shattered in a thousand pieces, just by giving her a bear hug. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Hi, I'm Dr. Nia Hergaris with today's tip for kids from the American Academy of Pediatrics. As parents, we want our children to grow up healthy and strong. That means helping teens take responsibility for their health as they become young adults. One way to do that is to make sure they have one-on-one time with their pediatrician. That helps them become comfortable talking about any health issue with their doctors and with you. So make sure to give your teen a voice. It's good for their health. For more on teen health, visit healthychildren.org.
I think it's just vapor.
Vaping is safer than smoking, isn't it?
There's really not even that much nicotine in them, right?
One vape pod has as much nicotine as one pack of cigarettes.
My kid knows it's dangerous.
5.4 million American kids vape, and most think it's harmless. Get your head out of the cloud. Talk to your kid about vaping. Visit talkaboutvaping.org. That's talkaboutvaping.org. Brought to you by the American Lung Association and the Ad Council.
Bruce Dumont, we are back on Beyond the Beltway, and before the break, Josh Cantrell had a quick question, so summarize your question, then we'll go to Jay Williams for the answer.
Yeah, Jay, my question was, usually it's the case that Israel is defending itself with its own air defense system, some of which are provided by the United States, either directly or through funding, but in this case, there were five countries or so involved in repelling this Iranian strike. And I just wanted to know from you, do you have any intel on the coordination that took place to do that among these countries?
I don't have any special intel, but the way these things work, I think what happened here is that there was a coordination in the sense of agreement of, you know, where are people going to be, where are their, what forces do they have, and what can they bring to the fight. And they didn't know exactly how the fight was going to go because they didn't know where exactly was the nature and timing of the attack. So I think what happened is that they all kind of attacked any of the incoming targets that were close enough for them to do it. And that's how they just kind of opportunistically, I suspect.
Joseph Shukani also joins us this evening. He is a Palestinian-American attorney. He will have a different perspective on as our discussion broadens this evening, but I think he may have a question or comment about Jay thus far.
Yeah, Jay, thank you for being on. Yusuf Shukani here in Chicago. You know, I was curious about, you know, Iran strike. Was this something that you feel to be, you know, their strongest might? Do you feel that this strike was something that they were really trying to penetrate and hurt Israel with and maybe even push further into a war, or was this some sort of maybe message of, hey, what you did to our consulate in Syria, you know, a few weeks back where right. You took out one of our majors,
yeah.
Was this something, you know, that was just a message of like, hey, the tick for tat, or was this something, you know, that was intended to go further?
Well, the Israeli attack on that outbuilding of the embassy in Damascus, Iranian mm-hmm. embassy, was yeah. in fact a great escalation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if they had caught these guys out in a war zone, then, you know, too bad for them. But in that case, it was a great escalation. In Iraq, Iran regards the killing of Iranians, especially in their consulates, as a bright red line, and Israel crossed it.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to do something. And I think this was not a massive all-on attack. I think they hoped to do more damage than they did. It kind of makes them look not quite as confident as people felt, as Bruce was saying. But I don't think this was intended to take out Tel Aviv or something like that.
Jay, a question that I have about the April 1st attack in Damascus, which killed the top soldier in Iran and several other military leaders. Is it possible for something like that to happen, which Israel made happen? How do you do something like that and not expect in a time of war that the other side is going to respond?
Yeah, that's a good point. The enemy always gets a vote, you know, whoever the enemy is. But you have to understand the position that everybody is in. The Iranian mullahs are worried for their own job security because they have to worry about their own population who aren't very happy with them. Netanyahu was having terrible political problems even before October 7th, mm-hmm. and his botched military preparations for that, ignoring intelligence and having the IDF miss not stationed near enough to where the threat was.
Right.
A massive, massive mistake, and it really is going to cost him politically. So he had to show strength, which, in his view, I think that explains some of the ferocity of the attacks in Gaza.
But by showing the strength the way he did it, by launching an attack in Damascus against Palestinians leading military leaders. It seems to me that also is the complete opposite of what President Biden has been attempting to say to Netanyahu, like, we're going to support you. We know you've got a war to win, but by golly, we want to know what your plan is in advance. Did the United States know in advance that Israel was going to attack Damascus and kill, military leaders? Across the way. I mean, that seems like a tremendous escalation. It is a time of war, but that doesn't sound like what Joe Biden's been trying to convince Netanyahu to do.
No, a U.S. would have. I don't think we did know about it. We surely would have tried to stop him if we did.
I would think so.
But you're right. These are all independent actors. In the final analysis, Iran's going to do what it does for its own national interest. So is Israel, and so will Palestinian leaders. And I'm hoping when all the smoke blows off, that there are going to be some leaders that can try to help pick up the pieces. And I don't envy them the job that they have in front of them.
Josh, got a comment?
I certainly concur with Jay's hopeful and optimistic approach. But as long as Iran is there and is funding to the tune of billions of dollars terrorist actions against Israel and terror groups right on Israel's doorstep, I don't think there's going to be a lot of hope for a settlement of this conflict. And so, you know, somebody mentioned that Iran may be a paper tiger. Yes, this attack failed, but I don't think they're a paper tiger. I mean, they have billions to spend on exporting terrorism across the globe, and they are a force to be reckoned with.
Yosef, when you heard of the Israeli attack in Damascus against the military leaders of the Palestinians, what was your reaction?
Well, I don't know if they were military leaders of the Palestinians. They were military leaders of Iran, and when Josh says that they support a terrorist group that is Hamas, it's interesting, I think the attacks on October 7th were terrorism. I think also what Israel has done, subsequently, to individuals, to the citizens of Gaza, to the tune of 33,000, I think that is also terrorist-like. And so, the term terrorist, to me, it's always thrown around, at Arabs specifically, but it's not thrown around at other groups that, seem to be causing a lot of terror themselves, especially in this area. And so, like you said, Bruce, going and killing a foreign government's, leaders at their embassy in a foreign country in Syria, I think that's a great escalation. And I think that causes a lot of conflict in that region. And I think that's terrorist-like. And so,
But it is. We have a war going on there, okay? And if Israel perceives, as they have done, that leadership against Israel is being directed by Iranian military leaders who are sitting enjoying a cocktail in, or they don't have cocktails, in Damascus, probably. Then that's part of the war. If you want to win the war, it's like, you know, Netanyahu is trying to win the war. Yep. Joe Biden doesn't like the way he's trying to win the war, because we have all of these videos from around the world showing you know, Palestinians being murdered and slaughtered.
Right.
So,
yeah, and every one of those Palestinian deaths primarily are the result of Hamas. There was a ceasefire on October 6th. Okay, so we're not going to interrupt, because there's a lot of times when I wanted to interrupt you, but there was a ceasefire on October 6th, and then Hamas attacked. Israel is responding to that attack. They are getting rid of Hamas, which is going to be good for everybody, for the Palestinian people and for the region generally. So we all ought to be thanking Israel for what they're doing. Every death is tragic.
How do you know? I'm going to give Joseph an opportunity, and also Jay respond. But again, to you, how do you know that Hamas is being eliminated? Is there a magic number that the world Jewish community is aware of, so that when you reach that number, you can say, "Ha, we won"?
Well, I don't know about a number, but certainly they've been degraded, because Israeli communities in the south, which have been, you know, terrorized for 20 years after Israel voluntarily pulled out of Gaza and left it to the Palestinians to rule, have been terrorized by rocket fire routinely. That is not happening anymore. So Hamas's military and terror capabilities have been degraded, but they have not been defeated yet, which is why Israel feels like they need to go into Rafah to finish the job.
Yosef.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly disagree. You say on October 6th there was a ceasefire in place. What ceasefire are you referring to, Josh?
There was a ceasefire in that there wasn't this war going on.
Oh, there wasn't this war. Was there an occupation going on? When you say that Israel gave it up to the Palestinians and that Gaza was completely controlled by the Palestinians, could people in Gaza move freely? Could they go to the West Bank? Could they leave their country? Did they have open borders? How do you define that it was fully in Palestinians' hands on October 6th?
So Israel got out of Gaza in 2005 under their hawkish Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and left it to the Palestinians.
What does that mean? Left it to the Palestinians?
And if there hadn't been terrorism instituted by Palestinians almost from the moment that Israel got out, the plan was that Gaza was going to be completely free. But Israel has a duty to protect its citizens, and there has not been any peace for the communities in southern Israel that are around the Gaza border and even further north. Because
there hasn't
of
been
the
peace
terrorist
in
activity.
Gaza since 1948.
When we come back, Joseph, you'll have an opportunity to respond to that when we come back. I also want to hear from Jay Williams on his assessment of where we go next and where the fingerprints really are in the Middle East. I'm Bruce Dumont. Don't go away.
This is Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com for Town Hall. Remember what Robert Gates wrote in his 2014 memoir about Joe Biden's foreign policy acumen? I think he has been wrong on nearly every foreign policy and national security issue over the past four decades, Gates concluded. Well, good news. Biden's streak remains unbroken. Last week, Biden demanded that Israel unilaterally declare a 6 to 8 week ceasefire in Gaza without even mentioning the hostages held by Hamas. In doing so, Biden gave Hamas a clear signal to remain firm on its maximalist demands and to hold the hostages, including at least five Americans, indefinitely. Biden lashed out at Benjamin Netanyahu for his mistakes in continuing the fighting, but the vast majority of Israelis support both the war and an assault on Rafah to destroy Hamas. For that matter, the vast majority of Americans do as well, and two-thirds in a recent Harvard-Harris poll oppose any ceasefire in which Hamas does not release all the hostages. Here's a better proposal. Biden should shut up for 6 to 8 weeks about Israel. I'm Ed Morrissey.
I think it's just vapor.
Vaping is safer than smoking, isn't it?
There's really not even that much nicotine in them, right?
One vape pod has as much nicotine as one pack of cigarettes.
My kid
knows it's dangerous.
5.4 million American kids vape, and most think it's harmless. Get your head out of the cloud. Talk to your kid about vaping. Visit talkaboutvaping.org. That's talkaboutvaping.org. Brought to you by the American Lung Association and the Ad Council.
Matthew.
Huh? Oh, sorry.
It's okay. I just need you to listen to me.
I know that a lot of times, Mom, it might not seem like I'm listening to you, but I am. I hear you. And what you say really does matter to me.
I mean, let's be honest. No kid likes rules, but I get why we have them. I hear you, and I know it's because you care.
All the talks we've had over the years, including what you've told me about not using alcohol and other drugs, they stick with me. And believe it or not, they really do make a difference, especially at times that matter most.
Hey, want a drink?
No, thanks, I'm good. So thank you, Dad, for talking and preparing me for what's ahead.
Thanks, Mom, for never giving up and always being my biggest fan.
Thank you for letting me know what you expect, so I can try to meet your expectations.
Thank you for talking.
For more information about talking with your kids about underage use of alcohol and other drugs, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
Let's be honest. The National Symphony may not be in his future, but he wanted to try violin. So you said yes because you love him. And if you love him that much, love him enough to make sure he's buckled up and in the back seat. Find out more about keeping your kids safe in your vehicle at nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Show them you love them. Keep them safe. Visit nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Bruce Dumont back, and this is the part of our program where we let each guest take a moment to introduce themselves. And we're going to start with Jay Williams, who joins us on the phone this evening from Macon, Georgia. Jay, give us your little background.
Hi, Bruce. I'm a recovering political science professor at Loyola University Chicago, living down here in Macon, Georgia, with less snow and more grandchildren, and still maintain relations up in Chicago. I'm on the board of directors of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library, and I get on the air with you whenever the opportunity arises. Also a retired captain in the U.S. Navy Reserve, with my specialty is social science teaching and military naval strategy.
Okay, thanks very much. Josh Scantrow.
Thanks, Bruce, for having me on the show again. It's great to be here. I'm a lawyer practicing technology litigation and privacy litigation. I defend companies when they get in those situations. And I'm a proud father of three, and I have a lovely wife. We live on the north side of Chicago, and I'm a Zionist and a proud Jewish American who has visited Israel more times than I can count. And I have many family and friends over there.
Quick question on a completely different subject. Do you support the banning of TikTok?
Oh, gosh. I'm close to supporting that, yes.
Okay. Good.
I'm not all the way there. I need more information, but I understand the impetus in both parties that people have raised the concerns.
Okay, thanks. Also making his maiden voyage on our program this evening is Yosef Skoukani.
Yes, I'm Yosef Skoukani. I'm a 29-year-old lawyer here.
He pronounces it a lot better than I do.
It happens. Even in grade school, you know, they would get to my first name, and then before they even said my last name, I would say, I'm here, you know, just because I knew. I grew up in Michigan, went to law school at Michigan State, started my legal practice here in Chicago, followed a girl here. I married my wife, Yara Rashad. Her family's from Orland Park and live there. We reside in West Loop. I'm running for local school council there, trying to be more involved in the community. My dad and family were born and raised in the West Bank, so born and raised in Palestine in that area. We go back and visit. My grandparents are still there. I've lost a total of 20 family members in Gaza, you know, who were indiscriminately bombed, unfortunately. You know, I'm a supporter of TikTok, being a part of the younger generation. And what I love about it is it provides information about all issues going on in the world, not just what the media here in the U.S. or in Western media wants you to see. So
we had a guest last week on this program that said that it is the images distributed by TikTok mm-hmm. that really has helped change mm-hmm. U.S. opinion and in some cases world opinion, because they're providing pictures that the big major media does not provide.
Right.
Do you agree with that?
On the Palestinian issue, of course. And I mean, I'm sitting here next to Josh, who, you know, is a self-proclaimed Zionist, and he's on the border of not wanting TikTok to be around anymore and is almost in favor of banning that. And so, yeah, it certainly makes sense, especially since, you know, if Zionism wants to continue, and, you know, and it's not important not to conflate Zionism with Judaism, just because most of my friends and activists who I, you know, go and rally with, you know, and support of Palestine or against the war that's going on, they are Jewish. You know, they are part of, you know, Jewish Voices for Peace and other important organizations. And so that's an important distinction. And yeah, I think that it's a major part of why TikTok is being banned is that Zionism factor.
Yeah, and I've got to respond to that.
Sure.
That has absolutely nothing to do with my concern about TikTok. Mm-hmm. When you asked me about TikTok, I was answering as a privacy attorney.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. That's why I asked it.
And China taking our secrets and continuing to, we don't know what China is going to do with all of this information that they are harvesting and gathering. It had nothing to do with the Middle East. Okay. So I stand by that comment. It's a bipartisan, I mean, it's like overwhelming majority right. of Congress. Mm-hmm. So I think I'm well within the majority there. And we can talk about Jewish Voice for Peace, which is certainly far from the mainstream. The Jewish community is united on Israel, 95%. And Americans and people across the world still get it.
Where do you get the 95% figure from?
Well, because I'm part of the Jewish community, and I see polling, and I see a lot of leftist Jews who we don't agree on anything to do with Israeli policy. They hate Netanyahu, etc. They are united in terms of Israel's mission to destroy Hamas. And a lot of them look at it as a humanitarian, from a humanitarian standpoint, not just to protect Israel, but this is the best thing for the Palestinians who have been imprisoned by Hamas for all these years.
And imprisoned by Israel as well, most of which by Israel, without their rights. They call them a democratic state, but unfortunately, Palestinians who are arrested and taken by Israel aren't afforded the same constitutional rights or any constitutional rights, even the right to have an attorney, even if they're under the age of 18.
Yeah, and all the Israelis that have been killed by Palestinian terrorists don't even get that far. I mean,
oh, and the
there have been bombings, and there have been... It has been – Israel has been under attack since 1948 when it was founded.
When it was
founded. It accepted two states, and the Arab countries didn't, the Palestinians included. They attacked Israel, and the conflict has raged since then.
Joseph, do you favor a two-state solution?
Well, I guess it all depends on what Israel is willing to give up. See, the two-state solution would depend on whether or not Israel would forego a lot of the settlement land that they have illegally taken. And when I say illegally, against international law and against various treaties, they've taken that land. And so would Israel be willing to give that land back to create a sovereign Palestine nation that's next to Israel, whether, you know, without arms or – It depends. I don't see Israel ever doing that. I don't see Israel ever giving back land to Palestine. And so I think what the two-state solution, the way it's currently been, is yes, there's this promise down the line for a two-state solution. But in the meantime, we're going to incrementally take the land via illegal settlements.
I can tell you the last time Israel did, in 2000, at the end of the Clinton term, Ehud Barak, who was a hawkish Israeli prime minister, accepted giving back 97% of the West Bank to the Palestinians. Yasser Arafat rejected it. Despite that, 6 years later, Ariel Sharon unilaterally, without any agreement whatsoever, removed 17 Israeli settlements and soldiers from Gaza. And it was the biggest mistake in Israel's history.
Do you agree with that, Yosef?
I completely disagree with that. I think that
Sharon, the role of Sharon, do you agree with that?
I don't
His
have
interpretation of Sharon.
I don't have enough information there to speak.
Those are just facts.
To speak to that, I think that there that those may be facts, but I think there's a lot that's missing from the table here, like the fact that when Yasser Arafat didn't agree with that, it's because there was other things booked into that agreement, not just the fact that they'd be getting back land. It's the certain land that they would be like getting back or taken. A lot of the land that Israel has taken has been the primary land around the sea, the primary land that's above, you know, when you go to the West Bank, Ramallah, which is the main city in the West Bank, is sitting low while all the settlements sit high and they look above.
Here's 97%.
Here's a question. This may be a dumb question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. It's not the first time I've ever asked a dumb question. Is there any land in the world or in that region of the world, Yosef, that could be determined as a Palestinian homeland? In other words, do you only want one specific piece of land? Or if the other Arab nations got together and said, you know what, we're all going to chip in a piece of our country and we're going to call it Palestine, would you accept that?
First, they want to live where they are. To live where they are. The Palestinians want to live where they are, right? To live in peace in Gaza,
right.
Live in peace in the West.
So the answer to my stupid question is that's not possible.
What? I know, and there's the Arab states around have done nothing whatever to help the Palestinians. Really, they have them cooped up in refugee centers. They won't let them assimilate.
How come?
But they shouldn't have to, right? Because that was their land. It shouldn't be on the Arab countries. I think a lot of the times we look at Arab countries and say what they're not doing, but instead it should be the fact that why is Israel pushing people out of Palestine? Why are Israel pushing people out of their homes? You know, when we talk about a genocide and we talk about 33,000 Palestinians being killed in Gaza and now a ground attack in Rafah, and we say it's for Hamas, but how can you claim that this is to get rid of Hamas and not the Palestinians?
Yosef, back to my question.
If Israel wanted to get rid of the Palestinians, they could do it tomorrow. Israel is fighting this war in this very dense area, and they're doing the best that they possibly can.
Oh, yeah.
But this is the result. Let's not forget what happened on October 7 when Hamas terrorists infiltrated Israel, killed, tortured, maimed, raped, killed 1,200 people, and
Israel
did all
daily.
Sorts of that. That's just not true.
It's true.
I mean, that is so not true. If Israel wanted to get rid of the Palestinians, they could do it.
How could they do it? How could they do it?
But they won't do it. I'm not going to even contemplate it because it's so awful. But Israel is a military power. They have the means to destroy if they wanted to, but they don't want to do it.
Do you agree with that?
They want a partner.
I want to ask Joseph. Do you agree with what Josh just said? That if Israel wanted to get rid of the Palestinians, they could do it because they have the military might and support in the world to do it. Yes or no?
I didn't say they had the support in the world. They don't have support in Israel.
Their own.
I'm saying if they wanted to, they don't want to. That's the point.
If they have nuclear weapons, could they destroy Palestinians that are by? They're doing it in a way right now that's systematically. They're doing that approach. They don't push away international, you know, support. Even though international support is already slowly dissipating, they're not going to do it overnight.
When we come back, we're going to hear from J. Allen Williams. He's been quiet for a segment, and we'll go to him when we return. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us tonight.
This is Dennis Prager. Sign up today for an unforgettable experience in Israel this October. Mike Gallagher and I are traveling to the Holy Land on the Stand with Israel tour with our trusted partner, Inspiration Cruises and Tours. This trip of a lifetime to Israel is one you don't want to miss. Register today before it's too late at StandWithIsraelTour.com, StandWithIsraelTour.com, or call 855-565-5519, 855-565-5519.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone.
One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support.
Why was the basketball court all wet?
Because the players kept dribbling on it.
The dad joke. Corny, groan-worthy, but also one of the simplest ways to share a moment with your kids.
What did the buffalo say when he dropped his son off for school?
Bye, son.
So take a moment to make your kid laugh, because dad jokes rule. Make your kid laugh today. Go to fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
What if the music stopped? If the familiar voices were silenced? If there were no breaking news updates? What if your companion and connection to your community came with a monthly fee? Don't worry, we're free local radio with you wherever you go. Celebrating 100 years and looking forward to the next 100. We are broadcasters. Text radio to 52886 and let Congress know you depend on your local TV and radio stations. This message furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters.
No word in the English language is less convincing than probably.
Are you sure we should get matching tattoos on our first date?
Sure. We'll probably stay together.
Probably? It's been 23 minutes since I ate. I can probably swim.
You should wait 30 minutes.
Okay, now tell me what to do. Cannonball! Cramp! Oh, I have a cramp. I can probably hit the green from here. Probably. Can I get a mulligan?
Ready to go?
Hey, are you sure you're okay to drive?
Yeah, I'm pretty sober. Yeah, I'm probably okay.
Probably okay isn't okay, especially when it comes to drinking and driving. If you're drinking, call a cab, a car, or a friend. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Bruce Dumont back on Beyond the Beltway. A reminder that at the top of the hour, in our next hour, we're going to be talking about O.J. Simpson. We're not going to do a big, you know, farewell to O.J. Simpson, because we understand that he wasn't the most popular guy in the world. But we are going to talk with someone, Paul Lisnick, who's a political analyst and a longtime writer, multi-book writer. And we're going to talk about, because he was there covering this trial, we're going to talk about the ramifications and how life in America, the political significance of the O.J. Simpson trial in the country. And also we'll be looking ahead to tomorrow, what's going to happen in New York City when Donald Trump is going to be the trial in Stormy Daniels, involving Stormy Daniels, begins. And the first several days are going to be about jury selection. And Paul Lisnick is an expert, who's written a book on the subject. So we're going to be talking about, can Donald Trump get a fair trial in New York City? One of the things we'll talk about. But again, back to our discussion. Jay Williams, you've been standing by for that last segment. I'm sure you have a comment or two.
Well, the first one is, it's really, really interesting to hear a principled and spirited, respectful discussion among people who all have strong points of view and who all know a lot. I like to hear that. And that's one of the things that your program does, Bruce.
Thank you.
It gets people together, makes people think.
Good.
I mean, full disclosure, I believe Israel has a right to exist inside of secure borders. I think that Palestinians have no friends, certainly very few in Israel. Their own leaders have not been good for them, particularly Hamas. Everyone would be better off if Hamas just disappeared tomorrow. But the problem that Israel has is that they do have a right to exist, in my view, and they responding to an act of war from the de facto government of Gaza. And the question, though, is, given that that's true, there's jus, you know, jus ad bellum, the justice of a war itself, and jus in bellum, the justice of how you're fighting the war. And it's the second area that people have a lot of questions about. Now, for Israel, Palestinians will never concede Israel's right to exist. They don't think. I wish that we could find some middle ground. I'm not sure there is one. The second really existential threat is the Iranian nuclear program. But the third one is one that has been triggered by this action in Gaza, and that is the loss of legitimacy and support. For many people, Israel are no longer seen as the good guys. And I think, frankly, Prime Minister Netanyahu is part of the problem, not the solution. It isn't clear. First of all, it completely messed up in the run-up to October 7th.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, I think that turning Gaza into Dresden in 1945 is not the answer. And many people, and including people like me who support Israel, have Israeli friends there. I've been there. I like it. I like the people. But it's a moral and strategic catastrophe. And so how do you get out of that? And in terms of Netanyahu, I think he is as concerned about his own political survival as he is doing something beneficial for Israel, because I frankly don't know what his plan is.
Mm-hmm.
This is not going to be solved militarily. And while this is going on, the settlers are taking more and more Palestinian land mm-hmm. illegally. And Netanyahu, whose supporters are the hard right of Israel politics, they're the ones that are doing it. He doesn't oppose it. And meanwhile, just recently, this Israeli settlers attacked, starting to attack Palestinian settlements in the West Bank. This is just unacceptable. I'm not smart enough to know what to do.
Can I interject here?
Go ahead, Josh.
Yeah. First of all, I would say I completely agree that Israeli settler attacks on Palestinians has to stop. It's wrong. It's illegal. These people should be put in jail. And when Israel finds them, that's exactly what happens to them. Number two, I generally agree with the comments about Netanyahu, but we have to separate Netanyahu pre-October 7th and his coalition and what he was doing with judicial reform and all of that, all of which is fair game to be questioned, from post-October 7th, where the actions of Israel, it's not just Netanyahu doing this. He represents a broad coalition. He's brought in coalition partners, political enemies, and he has broad public support in Israel mm-hmm. to try to eradicate Hamas.
You look yourself.
I completely disagree. He does not have broad support in Israel. There's been protests throughout Israel wanting to get Netanyahu out, and that was even predating October 7th when he was trying to reconstruct the judicial policy to make it not a democracy, but some sort of authoritarian rule, which him and his coalition have been doing.
Speaking of protests to try to get the leader out, I want to spend a moment on American politics. You are from Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
You know the importance of the Muslim vote in Michigan. Do you believe that the genie is out of the bottle insofar as allegiance to the Democratic Party by Arab Americans?
I don't think that the genie is ever out of the bottle. I think what it comes down to is, you know, who is going to provide rhetoric and take action in favor of Muslim and Arabs. I think Arabs and Muslim people throughout America have been looked past, and politicians would come out with comments or sort of in rhetoric that they say, yeah, we care about you, but really we just want your vote. And when push comes to shove, we're going to take action that may be undermined. And so if Biden comes out and has policy or put forth action that is in favor of Arabs and Muslims, I think that that table could turn.
Quick question to you, Joseph. Not Josh.
Sorry.
What the Republican Party, Donald Trump, and the American Jewish voter, where is that relationship right now?
It's going more and more to the Republicans. I mean, you've seen that happen in Florida. You saw it happen in the New York governor's race, where Republicans, Jews are voting about 50%.
Okay, on that
with
note.
Republicans.
Jay Williams, thank you very much for being with us in hour number one. We say farewell to you. Our guests in studio will continue with us for the next hour. They're both attorneys. They're on different sides of a lot of issues, perhaps even in the courtroom. We're going to hear their perspective on O.J. Simpson as a legal case, and we'll hear from Paul Lisnick, also an attorney. He joins us for the next hour, and we'll be talking about jury selection for Donald Trump tomorrow in New York City. Bruce Dumont back. We continue with Beyond the Beltway for hour number two. And our guests in studio, they remain. Josh Cantrell continues. And also Yosef Shkukani also joins us. We have both lawyers on either side of the Israeli-Palestinian issue. But they're both lawyers. So I thought they would be good guests to continue on this program. And we are joined by Paul Lisnick. He is the veteran political analyst for WGN Television in Chicago, noted winner of numerous awards, and also author of many, many books. But his initial claim to fame was he was one of the, as a young man, he was an analyst hired to look into the what was going on with O.J. Simpson. So, Paul, we've known each other for 30-plus years, so nice to have you with us on Beyond the Beltway. And I just want to begin by... because one of our guests this evening is 28 years old, and I assume we have some listeners that are in their 20s
or
30s.
Josh, you're talking
about, right? put in context for them, if you will, and obviously it's a stroll down memory lane for the rest of us. Put in context to what the O.J. Simpson trial was and how it changed American politics.
Well, that's a one-hour question right there, yep. Bruce. First of all, greetings to you, my old friend Josh. Yusuf will probably have me for his bar review course, I imagine.
good to see you, Paul, again.
You as well. Anyway, so listen, I can remember the old Bronco chase. I was teaching at Pepperdine at the time, and I was roaming around the Beverly Center, and a million people standing in front of this little key shop where they make keys. And I thought, what are they, giving away free keys? Well, it was the Bronco chase thing going on. Everybody's standing there and watching it. Let's fast forward a little bit to where things kind of happened and the question you're asking me about. I should clarify one thing, Bruce. So while I did analyze and cover the trial for NBC News at the time, I actually started as part of the Dream Team. So I was one of the jury consultants for the team. My partner was Joellen Demetrius, the tall blonde lady you still see in many, many cases, and Richard Gabriel, who was also working down the hall on the Heidi Fleiss case, which was going on at the very same time. And some people forget that. So we were part of that team since the beginning. And what happened was jury selection got underway and I was in the courtroom. But it was NBC who called and said, hey, look, we know you do television. Would you be willing to would you be willing to step out and kind of cover it for us on the Today Show? And, you know, the thought of limousines and Katie Couric replaced everything I was doing. So there we go. The reason I think the course remains as important as the trial remains as important as it is so many years later is because of what it said, the message, what it said about race relations, tensions between the races. And it was very much based on that back in the late 90s, when this thing was going on. Look, we know the way that the cops in the LA area, the Rodney King case had just happened a period of short years before that. And so when this happened, I think that a lot of African Americans saw this as basically a chance to come up. It's like, you know, you're always after minority folks out here. Here's one who we're going to stand behind. I'm going to answer your questions. There's reasons that the jury did what it did based on the jury selection, the research. I can share that. You take the conversation where you like.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us a little bit more about that jury selection, because as I mentioned in referencing your appearance on the program, obviously jury selection is going to start tomorrow for Donald Trump. So what are some of the basic things as a jury consultant? What are the basic things that you are recommending either to the defense or if you've worked for the prosecution? What are they looking for?
And in my career, I've worked on both ends, so very much so. But let me start with an OJ answer to that, and we'll work up to Trump. Mm-hmm. You know, very rarely are the demographics of potential or prospective jurors, are they determinative of what somebody will do? It's really about life experience, and that's what the lawyers need to do through their questioning, at least in state cases. I will tell you that the OJ case was one of the very rare exceptions where the demographics proved determinative of what somebody would do. So just by brief comment in terms of what happened back there, people think that, you know, OJ had this dream team and the prosecution had nothing. The prosecution had a guy named Howard Verinsky. They had their own jury consultant. They had the very same research. They knew everything that Johnny Cochran and the dream team knew. The difference was that Marcia Clark looked at that research and rejected it. She said, this profile of a defense juror, it's wrong. It's my juror.
And so ultimately, both sides were putting the very same people on the jury, African-American females in their 50s, more or less, not everybody. But and I will tell you, when that pick got the defense was a bit surprised by it. When the jury was picked, there was a champagne toast by the defense team at the end of that jury selection. For Trump, in the more directly response to your question, this is not one where people that will be where demographics will necessarily be dispositive of what somebody will do. Look, Trump has been doing everything he can to get the venue moved, to get the thing postponed because there's too much publicity. None of that is flying with the judge. First of all, there's nowhere in this country you could try the case and, you know, people haven't heard about it. Mm-hmm. The bottom line is the lawyers aren't looking for somebody who hasn't heard about this case. I'd be afraid of wanting somebody who hasn't heard about the case. The real danger here, Bruce, is not so much everybody. Listen, if any of us got called for jury duty, we probably all have 15 excuses on how to get out of it. The interesting thing is, and in OJ, the scary part were that so many jurors wanted to serve. And in fact, I think it was Bob Shapiro who made that comment to them. He goes, every case I'm in, nobody wants to be here. You people all want to be here. And that scares me. And that would be my sense of nerves in the Trump case, because you will have a lot of people who don't want to get dismissed. They want to serve.
Right. Also, earlier this week, I went to a public seminar sponsored by National Review with Vice President Pence and former Attorney General Michael Mukasey and also McCarthy. McCarthy of Fox News, who is their legal analyst, Andrew McCarthy. He was there, and this was during the reception after his presentation. He was talking about jury selection, and someone had asked him about, can Donald Trump get a fair trial in New York City? And as part of his answer was, yes, he thinks he can, because he said, you have to really look at it. He said, the elected officials, whether it's Eric Adams or whether it's Letitia James or whether it's Alvin Bragg, the number of people that turned out to vote in these elections where they were elected was very, very small. So you have a small turnout that elect these liberal leaders. So that says to him that there's a much broader group of people out there who chose not to vote or didn't like these people, and so that they conceivably, given the general demographics of the city and in particular, and the fact that Donald Trump was a very famous star for many, many decades in that venue, that he thinks that Donald Trump could get a fair trial in New York City because the media and everyone else is sort of overreacting to the current demographics of their perception of New York. Any reaction to that?
I think he can get a fair trial. Look, again, an OJ reference, but I remember running into Gil Garcetti one night before the trial got underway, and I said, why are you doing this trial in downtown L.A., which is very difficult for the prosecution? Why aren't you going to Brentwood, where Nicole lived, or something like that? And his answer was that his feeling was that he needed to do it in downtown L.A. because basically he had more evidence against OJ than he had against 90% of the cases that he won. So he had no fear. I already gave you the reason things went the wrong way. With Trump, here's the thing, and I think my lawyer colleagues here would attest. You know, people can come in.
Hang on one second, Paul. Okay. We've got a break. I want you to put that theory out there and see if our lawyers agree with it when we come back. I'm Bruce Dumont. This is Beyond the Beltway. Thanks for joining us tonight.
As a local business owner, you get called every week by marketing companies. We get it. We have hundreds of satisfied customers. Here's what a satisfied client recently said.
Open enrollment is going great. We're hitting record numbers. Thank you so much for this report. It really is amazing to see how the marketing is really shaping our enrollment around the city.
If you're a local business and ready for the next step, visit surroundchicago.com right now. Our experts are ready to help you take your marketing to the next level. Visit surroundchicago.com today.
In the new video series, Fault Lines, Professor Vodi Bonkam examines the threat of woke social doctrine versus biblical justice.
The religion of anti-racism has no redemption. We have to be right about what God requires in this critical moment.
Discover the fault lines beneath today's cultural divide.
What God are you trying to appease?
Fault Lines, the 10-part video series and essential 6-part study guide. Available at salemnow.com. Salemnow.com.
No word in the English language is less convincing than probably.
Are you sure we should get matching tattoos on our first date?
Sure. We'll probably stay together.
Probably? It's been 23 minutes since I ate. I can probably swim.
You should wait 30 minutes.
Okay, now tell me what to do. Cannonball! Cramp! Oh, I have a cramp. I can probably hit the green from here. Probably. Can I get a mulligan?
Ready to go?
Hey, are you sure you're okay to drive?
Yeah, I'm pretty sober. Yeah, I'm probably okay.
Probably okay isn't okay, especially when it comes to drinking and driving. If you're drinking, call a cab, a car, or a friend. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
This is the story of a very special woman. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician or an entrepreneur. Her knowledge was limitless and still is. She could also make monsters disappear, especially those that lurked in the shadows under the bed. Once, this woman put back together a teenage girl's broken heart, which had been shattered in a thousand pieces, just by giving her a bear hug. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Bruce Dumont back. We continue with Beyond the Beltway, and Josh Cantrell has a question for Paul or a comment. Go ahead, Josh.
It's really more of a comment. I'm fascinated with the whole OJ thing, and I'm sure we'll get back to that. But Paul, your comment that you think that Donald Trump can get a fair trial in Manhattan, I really don't think so. I mean, people have such strong opinions about Trump. They hate him there. What makes you think he can get a fair trial?
Well, good question, Josh, and good to see you. Look, as a trial lawyer, I was a trial lawyer before I was anything else. One of the things I came to know is that jurors actually do understand what it means to do the right thing. There are some who want to pull something over on the lawyers. Like I said, in OJ, the jurors who really wanted to serve scared the lawyers more than anybody. So in this situation, the judge has already released 42 questions. Perhaps you all have seen them. 42 mm-hmm. questions that these jurors will have to answer as part of the jury discussion process. And remember, in the end, as you know, Josh, you're not picking jurors. You are deselecting. You're getting rid of everybody. The hope is it leaves you with people somewhere in the middle. And the bottom line answer to that question is, I actually do believe that many people do try and do the right things. They sometimes come back and surprise us with going after some politician or letting somebody go. I think they often try and do the right things if the lawyers do a good job at the selection process.
And if you, and all you really need is one person on that jury to vote to acquit. That gets you
a hung jury, and then the prosecution has to decide to try it again or not.
Do you think they would? I mean, I say this in all the cases wherever there is a trial by jury, I would say that Donald Trump, given his showmanship, notwithstanding the things that of a negative that people know about him, I think he wins in a jury trial. But not all of his trials are jury trials.
Well, one clarification I would say to that, Bruce, is that, look, you know, right now we're all living the media, right? Everyone I covered on television, you all watching it all day long. The bottom line is when those jurors get in the courtroom and Donald Trump is sitting at that table, most likely he is, he's supposed to be, and going through it, I mean, all of the media stuff, first of all, they will be told not to look at any media, not to be watching TV. They really will make a promise to avoid all of that stuff. Yes, they will come in with their views of Trump. But by the time they hear the instructions from the judge about what their job is, I do believe that jurors know how to focus in on the evidence in the case. This evidence is not about whether you love Donald Trump. It's not even about arguably hush payments to a porn star. It's a documents case. And I think what the prosecution is going to show, there were these checks, they were written, they were fraudulently written in the records. That's where all this stuff is ultimately going to go. The world will not want to hear that because we want to hear salacious stuff. But in the end, the jurors will be guided by a jury form, the verdict form, that's going to say, did this happen? Did this happen? Did this happen? And all the stuff, Josh, that it's fair enough to be concerned about, I think that is blocked out once you get to the decision process.
Yosef Shukani is here, and he acknowledged during the break that he was in the Pampers at the time of the trial. But again, during law school, he said that the trials and tribulations of O.J. Simpson and the Dream Team were frequent fodder in the classroom. So he's got some questions or comments for you.
Yeah, thank you.
Now I'm in Pampers. So I don't
know. Yep. So I was born in '95, so about 1 year old, you know, when the trial was going on. But you know, it was a big part throughout law school. Just you know, that Dream Team. You know, if the glove doesn't fit, you must acquit. And so I'm wondering here, do you feel like this is another monumental trial similar to the O.J. Simpson trial, especially since we have New York City? That one was in L.A., so we, you know, the big metropolitan areas. And, you know, my question is, what sort of jurors would the Donald Trump team be looking for? You mentioned the demographic earlier with O.J. Simpson being that middle-aged black woman, you know, kind of going for that. What would be the ideal juror for Donald Trump and his team?
First of all, one thing, since you were kind enough to mention the Johnny Cochran line, if it fits, you must acquit. We got to give credit where credit is due. Johnny didn't write that line. That actually came from Gerald Ullman, who was a law professor out in San Diego at the time. Johnny got the line. Johnny got all the credit and deserves the credit, I suppose. But the answer here is I can't give you an answer like, well, we're looking for, you know, Caucasian men and whatever, because typically they're not. But you could probably fill in that part of it yourself. What you're looking for are those answers specifically to those 42 questions. Anybody who answers those, who has ties to, and these are the questions. Are you part of the Proud Boys? Are you part of the Oath Keepers? Have you gone to a Trump rally? By the way, in fairness, for Trump supporters out there, they're also asked, have you gone to a Biden event? Do you get Biden newsletters? All that stuff has to come in. So clearly, what you're looking for with regard to a prosecutor, you want people who are law and order people, people who say, if you violate the law, then you need to pay the price. It doesn't matter who you are. Nobody's above the law. Those can be teachers. Those can be police officers. Those could be anybody who lives their life in that way. And we'll find out through those questions. By the way, one interesting juror on the OJ case, somebody got through, and I'll never forget this. His name was Michael. But I don't know if I should say his name. Anyway, his name was Michael. And I remember sitting in the courtroom, and he looks at OJ, and he gives him a thumbs up. And he had made it on the jury. Nobody caught that. At that point, I was working for NBC. It wasn't ethical. I was an ethics commissioner in Illinois for a lot of years. I didn't think it was ethical to step in and let them know that. I will say that within a couple of weeks, they removed him from the jury and claimed he had a book deal, which he never did.
A question on the OJ trial, as you reviewed it, sat there through it, at what point in the trial did you know there was going to be a significant shift in how the verdict will ultimately come down? Or did you know get-go?
Listen, well, you know, if anything goes on outside the Trump trial, it'll be protesters and stuff. I actually took some of this stuff out of a bag. Just the paraphernalia. I've got T-shirts, buttons. You have no idea. This one says guilty or not guilty. This one says don't squeeze the juice. I mean, the people that made a ton of money, you're not going to see that kind of stuff in the T-shirts and everything over here. That's not going to happen with Donald Trump. It's a very different kind of momentum. There was an entertainment momentum that could be there with Trump, but I just don't think it's going to be. So there was that kind. When did I think it was going to shift? It was hard to know. That trial went on for 9 months. And some question as to OJ paying his defense bills, but that part may line up with some other cases. But anyway, what I can tell you is this. When the jury went out to deliberate, we were all on our way home. I was headed back to the airport. Johnny was going back to San Francisco. 3.5 hours later, we got a phone call. The jury is back. 3.5 hours later. And so I'm in the media, I'm in studio and talking about it, and everybody wanted a prediction. And I said, look, well, it's tough to predict. And by the way, I was wrong here. I said, look, and my colleague lawyers will know this, typically when a jury comes back that quickly, it suggests that it is a conviction. Because if they had been out, there's another rule that says a jury's out for a day for every week they're on trial. All of these are guidelines. But they should have been out for weeks looking at this, at least a week. The fact that they were back so fast, it seemed to me that it was an immediate It was going to be an immediate conviction. Of course, it went the other way for all the reasons we discussed, which is those jurors were not inclined to go after him in the first place. And I think that's why it went that way. I do remember waking up the next morning in the hotel and F. Lee Bailey was on the Today Show and he was sort of going after me because he was on the Dream Team. But at this point, I'm media and going after he goes, even Lisnick got it wrong and whatever. And I'm just was so angry.
going back to the trial, but if the name Mark Furman had never been uttered and had never been part of this trial, would O.J. Simpson ultimately have been convicted?
With that jury, I'm always likely to say, no, I don't think so. But Mark Furman, and for folks who don't remember who Mark Furman is, he was a police officer. But you got to give the Dream Team credit the same way you got to give Trump's lawyers credits. I mean, the background work they do and the searching they do for stuff like in Atlanta, for example, how many weeks did we spend trying to learn about an affair that Fannie Willis was having? It could or could not be relevant to things, but it doesn't matter. It took the focus. And that's what Mark Furman did. And the Dream Team grabbed on to his. And they had him on tape using the N-word, using all sorts of terrible phrases. And yeah, that was incredibly costly. But it goes back to what I said, which is those jurors who ultimately sat on the jury, those were folks who eventually saw this as payback time anyway. Mm-hmm. And so it fit right within. If anything, it gave them the strength to maybe move more quickly than the 3.5 hours than they did.
Josh.
I mean, nine months of testimony, 3.5 hours. This, in my view, was jury nullification for what happened with Rodney King. Is that a view that you share?
Yeah, I do. And that's one of the reasons I kind of mentioned Rodney King. Again, people may not even remember that case. And our office did Rodney King as well. So we worked in that as well. And if you remember, you know, there, at least the first time around, you know, the cops are, you know, nobody was holding officers responsible. There's a lot of great cops. I'm not going after cops. But when one does something wrong, they should be held accountable. In the second trial, the federal trial, which is the one we worked in. And the jury came back, and that was brilliant. I actually teach this in my seminars. The notion is, you know, if they remember after the first trial, L.A. was burning, right?
Right.
And in the second trial, the fear was if they let the cops go, L.A. burns again. And if they convict all the cops, now you've got blue flu in L.A. And I don't know if you all remember. Josh, do you remember what the jury did in that second federal case?
I do not know.
Most people don't, and that's because there was peace. What they did was they convicted two and they let two go. Mm. And essentially two who were really bad and two who were just sort of there, and that seemed to be what it took for L.A. to look and say, okay, we can live with it.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Well, it's hard to you really cannot dismiss. Obviously, we're talking about the O.J. trial and O.J. Simpson tonight, but really you cannot really separate that from Rodney King and the atmosphere that existed not only in Los Angeles, but really around the country because of the coverage that was going on there, that some of the racial connotation of those of that first trial certainly spilled over to the O.J. Simpson. And then it just became, you know, an incredible daily drama. And I want to talk more about that. And also, we got a break right now. And then we'll
be back. Didn't have cell phones at the time. That's what I wanted to say.
Say what?
We didn't have cell phones. We couldn't take videos back then.
You're right.
Right. So true.
We'll be right back with a call for you, Paul, and everybody else. I'm Bruce Dubon.
In the new video series, Fault Lines, Professor Vodi Bauckham examines the threat of woke social doctrine versus biblical justice.
The religion of anti-racism has no redemption. We have to be right about what God requires in this critical moment.
Discover the fault lines beneath today's cultural divide.
What God are you trying to appease?
Fault Lines, the 10-part video series and essential 6-part study guide. Available at salemnow.com. Salemnow.com.
Dad, I picked up your pills, made your lunch, and your laundry is done.
When you care for a loved one, you take care of everything. But are you taking care of yourself? Find free care guides at aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
This is the story of a very special woman.
In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician or an entrepreneur. Her knowledge was limitless and still is. She could also make monsters disappear, especially those that lurked in the shadows under the bed. Once, this woman put back together a teenage girl's broken heart, which had been shattered in a thousand pieces, just by giving her a bear hug. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
No word in the English language is less convincing than probably.
Are you sure we should get matching tattoos on our first date?
Sure. We'll probably stay together.
Probably? It's been 23 minutes since I ate. I can probably swim.
You should wait 30 minutes.
Okay, now tell me what to do. Cannonball! Cramp! Oh, I have a cramp. I can probably hit the green from here. Probably. Can I get a mulligan?
Ready to go?
Hey, are you sure you're okay to drive?
Yeah, I'm pretty sober. Yeah, I'm probably okay.
Probably okay isn't okay, especially when it comes to drinking and driving. If you're drinking, call a cab, a car, or a friend. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message brought to you by NHTSA and Ad Council.
Bruce Dumont back. We continue with another segment of Beyond the Beltway, and we've got a caller on the line. He's listening to us in Boise, Idaho. Kevin, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, thank you, Bruce. It's been a long time since I've called in, but I sure love your show.
Terrific. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm really sorry for what I just heard. The excitement of somebody who is so excited that he got one of the world's greatest domestic abusers and a murderer given a non-guilty verdict. I mean, that is the saddest thing I've ever seen in America. I mean, this guy beat that lady, his ex-wife, just unbelievably over the years, and that's not disputed. And the things that happen, America knows it's a different situation. And from that situation, we now have a different world where all we do is we pick jurors. And I am up for jury duty next month. I'm a farmer in Idaho. I've been called up 7 times in my life. At 60 years old, I've been on a jury 7 times coming up this spring. My wife has never been called up in her life. Mm-hmm. But the last time I was called up, I had a person in front of me who they questioned me and said, well, this person will not take the stand in his own defense. There's video evidence, and he will not take the stand. How do you feel about that? Well, O.J. Simpson was one of the first people to never take the stand in his own defense. If I was on my own defense, I would take the stand. I would scream of my own innocence. And what I said in that whole situation was, well, we know one person who never took the stand in his own defense. That was O.J. Simpson. We know how that turned out. And I was dismissed within seconds, and I poisoned the entire jury. And from that point on, that guy was found guilty. And he was guilty. But you know what? You people should be ashamed of yourselves. When somebody is guilty, you give them a fair defense, but you don't try to get a guilty person to the point of innocence. That's wrong.
All right. Let me go back. I'm not quite sure why you're upset with everybody on the show tonight, but I think the person that you might be most upset about is Paul Lisnick, who as an analyst was describing what he saw and heard first person in the trial. So I want to let Paul sort of respond to your question, but stay on the line because I want to follow up on it as well. Paul, I hate to throw the hot potato to you, but I think he was referencing some of the things that you had to say.
Look, I do television every day. I get it. I get emails. I understand. And Kevin, here's what you didn't, what you seem to think you've heard, excitement, whatever. You have not heard that. What you are hearing are people in this panel who are experienced at doing media. So keeping you awake and with us is important. And that's why you get the energy you get from me. None of this is excitement over the verdict in the case. Bruce has not asked anybody, do you think OJ did it or anything? We're not talking about that. We're talking about how something quite historical happened. How did it happen? And that's what we're addressing. By the way, OJ was on the stand. If you remember, OJ was on the stand and he tried to fit the glove on and all of that. Like it or not, but it was a masterful job in the way things were handled. That doesn't make it right. It doesn't mean he didn't kill anybody. It doesn't mean any of that. But it does mean that lawyers have a job to do. And in my explanation, I explained why I think things ended up the way they did. And by the way, as I said back then, I was wrong because I thought after 3 hours a jury was going to convict. The mistake was in the jurors who got seated. I wouldn't go after Johnny Cochran.
During the break, Yosef was telling a story about what he had heard over the years about the use of salt tablets with O.J. Simpson. Put that in context, that story.
Yeah, Yosef. So you know, I guess for me, not being there around, you know, I've learned and heard about.
You missed so much.
I missed so much. Yeah, we talked about JFK in the meantime.
I'm here with the response, if I may.
Go ahead.
You know, I hear what you say, but the thing is we in America know that juries are a mess. I mean, we take people who have no knowledge of anything. I mean, not even their ABCs or high school graduation. We try to pick the dumbest juries we can, but what we want to do is we want to get justice, and justice is including a guilty verdict. This guy should have been found guilty, and I'm really ashamed that the legal system didn't do that.
Kevin, that's clear to me, but my question to you is, what alternate system would you have in place of what we do have in our jury system in America?
I would probably say, like our founders, that you cannot be a voter unless you own property, unless you're somebody who is more vested in the system, more knowledgeable, more educated, and we shouldn't discriminate on juries based upon their knowledge and their ability to think. We should have juries picked. You know, we take people and their trials, like here in Idaho. We have a guy who came from Pennsylvania and killed four Idaho people, and they're trying to move the jury out of that small town. Well, you're supposed to be convicted of or judged by a jury of your peers, but they're trying to take it away, and that's not right.
We should have juries
of our peers and juries of intelligent people.
I want to go back and ask Paul one follow-up, then Josh has got a follow-up. Paul, do you... Kevin has interpreted that in the jury selection process that defense attorneys are looking for the dumbest of the dumb. How would you put it? I don't think you would put it in those terms, but educated person, do they have the skills to decipher defense and prosecution cases? Do they have the smarts to digest it?
The answer is yes, and a couple things in response to Kevin. Number one, first of all, the lawyer's job. In a complicated case, bank fraud, whatever it may be, lawyers have to be able to explain the case to the jury. If the jury doesn't understand it, that's a fault of the lawyer, and that's sometimes why they don't want to try it in front of a jury. But by the way, when Kevin was talking, I think he mentioned he's a farmer. You know, we don't have cases where if a mifepristone case, an abortion pill, goes to a jury, that we need to have scientists and drug experts on the jury. That's what the FDA is for. So the fact that I hope one day, and I don't know what Kevin's trial might be this time around, but if Kevin is being called in for a murder case or a fraud case or a car accident, whatever it may be, they'll want to know what Kevin's life views are, but is Kevin qualified to sit on a jury and judge one of his peers? Absolutely. And I would love to have him on a jury. Why not? Unless he's biased in a way that wouldn't be fair to the client, to the defendant.
I just wanted to add that I fully concur with Kevin's view that O.J. Simpson was guilty. It was clear as day. There's no doubt that O.J. Simpson was guilty. But I would push back on comments about, you know, voters having to own property and things like that. I mean, we got away from that in this country, and I think it's a good thing that we did that.
I agree.
When we were talking about what happened in the country, obviously, there was a black-white divide during that trial period. But also, as a young Jew, what was going on in black-Jewish relations, given the fact that, Ron Goldman was Jewish? His father was probably the most famous figure in the case next to O.J.
Yes, and his sister.
What was that going on? Because there was an anti-Jewish perspective was part of what was going on, too, I think.
Yeah, that's my recollection. Secondarily, I mean, Jews are viewed by many people as white, although that's debatable. But what black-Jewish relations peaked in the 60s with the civil rights, and they've been downhill since then. And there's been progress, there's been efforts to rebuild that coalition, but it hasn't happened. And certainly there was that element.
But how much of it was perpetuated by those involved in the fact that one of the victims of O.J. was a young Jewish man?
Well, I think that it didn't help things, but there were many other things going on in the country since or before that and since then that have played a role in the deterioration of that alliance.
Did you sense Paul?
Yeah, I get. My mind has shifted to something. I know we're coming up to a break, so there's something, if you don't mind, I just want to refer to this, especially given Kevin's comments, and it's not quite related to what Josh said. But here's the bottom line. You also have to remember that one of the reasons O.J. may have gotten off is because the prosecution, which has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he did it, they made all sorts of mistakes. There were shoes, bloody shoes, that were to be kept in a refrigerated truck. The refrigerated truck was broken, therefore not workable. The DNA, that was the case that gave us DNA. The DNA was from the killer was all over Nicole Brown Simpson. The cops rolled her up in a blanket, destroyed the identical DNA. The only point I want to say is we could all agree here. And by the way, if you go to Johnny, well, Johnny's gone, but if you were to ask Johnny, did O.J. do it? Johnny would say he never asked him. Criminal defense lawyers tend not to ask that question. The bottom line is the cops made a lot of huge mistakes, and the defense knew how to teach the jury that you got to do it right or you don't go to jail. That was what was going on. So I thought it was just important to make that. I'm sorry I didn't address the Jewish issue.
To build on that, you know, I think that preserving the evidence is incredibly important, and then I think that case, it hurt the prosecution. And another point to what Kevin was saying is that, you know, on the litigation, even on the defense side, we're not looking for dumb jurors. You know, we're not trying to put the dumbest jurors, you know, up there. What we're looking for is people who are not biased, you know, who are going to look at the evidence in one way because of a past experience that they had, and then ultimately make a decision that's not very fair for ultimately the case or that defendant, you know, who's on the stand. And so, you know, we're just looking for that bias aspect, not so much on the intelligence side. So going back to what Joshua was saying, I think it's incredibly important that we don't base it on land and who owns land to determine who can be a juror.
And also, it takes just one person for a hung jury. One person.
What happened in the first LaGuardia?
That's trial. One person.
One person.
Yes.
Those things happen. That's the system we have. We'll be back with our final segment. I'm Bruce Dumont. Don't go away.
Matthew.
Sorry.
It's okay. I just need you to listen to me.
I know that a lot of times, Mom, it might not seem like I'm listening to you, but I am. I hear you. And what you say really does matter to me.
I mean, let's be honest. No kid likes rules, but I get why we have them. I hear you, and I know it's because you care.
All the talks we've had over the years, including what you've told me about not using alcohol and other drugs, they stick with me. And believe it or not, they really do make a difference, especially at times that matter most.
Hey, want a drink?
No, thanks, I'm good. So thank you, Dad, for talking and preparing me for what's ahead.
Thanks, Mom, for never giving up and always being my biggest fan.
Thank you for letting me know what you expect, so I can try to meet your expectations.
Thank you for talking.
For more information about talking with your kids about underage use of alcohol and other drugs,
Visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
No word in the English language is less convincing than probably.
Are you sure we should get matching tattoos on our first date?
Sure. We'll probably stay together.
Probably? It's been 23 minutes since I ate. I can probably swim.
You should wait 30 minutes.
Okay, now tell me what to do. Cannonball! Cramp! Oh, I have a cramp. I can probably hit the green from here. Probably. Can I get a mulligan?
Ready to go?
Hey, are you sure you're okay to drive?
Yeah, I'm pretty sober. Yeah, I'm probably okay.
Probably okay isn't okay, especially when it comes to drinking and driving. If you're drinking, call a cab, a car, or a friend. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message brought to you by NHTSA and Ad Council.
This is the story of a very special woman. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician or an entrepreneur. Her knowledge was limitless and still is. She could also make monsters disappear, especially those that lurked in the shadows under the bed. Once, this woman put back together a teenage girl's broken heart, which had been shattered in a thousand pieces, just by giving her a bear hug. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Bruce Dumont back, and in the last segment, I asked Joseph to tell a brief story that he had heard, I guess, in law school, and it was about salt tablets and what the defense was trying to do. I want you to tell the story that you've heard, and I want to see if Paul has heard that same story.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it was from the law school class or recent articles, but there was, you know, some messaging around his trial team, O.J. Simpson's trial team, where he would stop taking his arthritis medication as well as increase his sodium intake for his diet. And in that process, his hands and really his whole body kind of swelled up a little bit. So when he put on the glove mid-trial and it didn't fit, and we obviously have that vivid image in all of our heads, you know, it was because of the steps that they took beforehand to kind of get him
and
to be a little bit more swollen.
That was a pivotal point in the case,
right,
when he took the stand. And again, the glove did not fit. Paul, have you ever heard that story about bulking up your fingers?
Scientifically, I know that may work, but no, I never heard about it tied to OJ. I mean, to me, the explanation always was that, you know, that what they had him try on was this bloodied up, dried glove, and that, I mean, it's going to shrink. I mean, there's no question. The whole point of it was just sort of a silly thing to do because, of course, it's not going to fit. And when the prosecution said, here, try on this brand new large glove, it fit. And of course, Johnny Cochran was right to say, so all they showed was that he wears a size large in the glove. So I had not heard the salt tablet thing. I do know when they toured his home, by the way, one of the things they did was they made sure like nice family pictures were up and that sort of thing. That's the kind of thing a lawyer may step in and do. You can question the ethics of that as well if things aren't the way it was supposed to look back then. But the salt tablets was not a story I had heard.
Well, insofar as those pictures are concerned, the story that I have heard for many years was that because O.J. Simpson was just this one of the most well-liked Americans in the world by mostly white people, he wasn't necessarily beloved by black people because he traveled in different circles. No pun intended.
That's a great
when
point.
The trial came around, when the jury went on that visit of the home, OJ's home, what the jury had done is they had gone through and they had found pictures of OJ with famous black people, which he had many, And those pictures went out, and the pictures of OJ with you know, a roster of white celebrities, they were, you know, put in the drawer somewhere. So the perception was that OJ was this beloved person within the African-American community. And when this trial started, and when he first became known as a possible suspect, he was anything but a beloved figure in the African-American community, but he became one because of the way the defense and the way the prosecution conducted the case.
And probably because of the issues we've already talked about. Look,
right.
You know, Donald Trump is an incredibly rich guy. Why the strong connection to workers and laborers and people who, you know, will never know the kind of money he has in their lives? Because sometimes there's a connection that goes deeper. People connect at a different level. And so, yeah, that did happen with OJ. But I give a lot of credit to Johnny Cochran, too, for making that connection with the jurors. It just, you know, Johnny was incredibly powerful in the courtroom and jurors liked him. People that, and, you know, you remember, by the way, when the verdict was announced, they showed black and white groups around various places,
yes,
around the country and the
right.
difference in the divide. So once again, I'm going to go back to Kevin and say, I get that he's incredibly upset that he thinks a guilty person walked free. I'm not saying a guilty person didn't walk free. We also handled the civil case, by the way, for OJ, where he was hit with multi-million dollar verdict in the civil case where the burden of proof is less.
Yep. Well, also we should mention that with Donald Trump and with OJ Simpson, they both were celebrities. Before their before their fame put them in a courtroom, they were liked by lots of people. There's a lot of people now who despise Donald Trump that used to be his friends. But when he became a president and he had a political persuasion, they completely turned on him. But again,
right.
you can't necessarily put a price on celebrityhood. But you know, when O.J. Simpson walked into a room or Donald Trump walked into the room, they walk into that room with something that most defendants don't have.
Yes, but as I said, within a period of time, the jurors come to see that person as the defendant in the case where they have to look at the evidence. My office handled the Phil Spector case. You remember that one?
Yep.
A murder case. And there was a hung jury, as you say, Bruce, that first time around. We did that case. He then fired us. His comment was, you got OJ off, but you didn't get me off. And in the second case, he didn't work with us and he was convicted. Another case where the jurors went to his home, turned around. These are fascinating cases. And probably because of the celebrity component of it, I still stand by the fact that jurors attempt to do the right thing when the lawyers give them the information in the proper way. And by that, I mean in an understandable way.
Yeah, I would just have to push back a little bit on my friend Paul and say the prosecution made some mistakes. The police made some mistakes, detectives, etc., but they put on an overwhelming case of guilt with regard to OJ. And in that case, the jury really wasn't reading the instructions and intent on doing the right thing. Heck, if they had read the instructions, they would have been in there for longer than 3.5 hours. It was nullification. And that's it, due to Rodney King. And it's just the prosecution never had a chance looking back at it.
Yeah. I don't disagree.
Okay. That's good. We have agreement.
We have an agreement. Yeah. Joseph, we've all agreed here. We've come to the end of our
–
we have got to end the show because everybody is now agreeing with the basic set of it. But again, Paul, thank you very much. Again, for those of us who have been around radio and TV for a long time, as have you, as have myself, it's interesting to go back, 20, 30, 40 years in some cases, to relive stories that were very important to the evolution of news in America. And again, with you here, Joseph, it's nice to know that we're sharing it at least with someone who's 28 years old. Hopefully we have other 20-something and 30-somethings out there listening to the program and watching us on YouTube. But again, that's one of the reasons why you should keep some old guys around. They have lots of stories. But again, Joseph, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Josh, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bruce.
Paul Lisnick, thank you very much for joining us. Again, politics on WGN television every Sunday morning with his politics show. And again, you can hear him on WGN News as well from coast to coast and border to border. He's written about 15 books, all of which are very important to read. I can't go through them right now, but you can find them at paullisnick.com. Thanks to Fritz Goldman for his assistance in the production of the program. This is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.